Dog Works Training Centers, professional dog training in Denver, Colorado, and Anchorage, Alaska, presents Mush You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush You Huskies is part of Twine Group Media and is syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here are your hosts, Robert and Michelle Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto hosting Mush You Huskies live from the mushing capital of the world, Willow, Alaska. And sitting on my right is our sometimes co-host of Mushing Radio and Mush You Huskies, Michelle. How's it going?
It's going great. I'm enjoying the 29-degree weather, and the sun is still shining at 6:30 in the evening, which is fabulous. Usually we have been well past dark at this time.
That's exactly right. So pretty soon it'll be midnight and we'll be out working in the garden well past our bedtime. So I'm looking forward to that. But before we get too far into talking about life in Alaska, we got to mention our other co-host calling in from sunny California, Alex Stein. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's about to stop being sunny. We're going to get the storm that hit the Anchorage area a couple days ago is making its way down here and is prepared to sock us with 3 to 4 inches of rain over the next day or two.
You know, that storm almost pushed Anchorage over the record snowfall for the year.
Yep, but I have a feeling they're still going to be able to make it over that record.
I do too.
Anchorage this year has had almost 11 feet of snow, and we've had quite a bit more of that here in Willow. And I was talking to Sylvia Vertwangler, I believe how you pronounce it. I guess when you're German, you know your last name is going to be butchered every time somebody says it. But she said, I got a little story to tell about her in just a little bit, but she said one of the toughest things on the trail this year was the snow conditions. And I know she dropped out and scratched in Nikolai, the first person to scratch in the 2012 Iditarod. But she said the snow was just brutal on the early parts of the race.
Yeah, you know, we were expecting that the snow was going to make this a very, very slow race. And that's what we thought, and that's what a lot of people who are monitoring and watching the Iditarod thought. And, in fact, there was a ton of snow, some of it very wet snow, some of it making the going pretty hard, but I have to say the dogs and the mushers managed to, for the most part, make it through in pretty fast times.
Yeah, exactly. And I talked to my friend Hugh Neff this afternoon for the first time. They got terrible cell phone coverage up in Nome. If more than two people are on the cell phone at the same time, somebody gets dropped. But anyway, I spoke with him this afternoon, and he said the same thing. It was pretty brutal, that first section of the trail, and he ended up pulling a muscle pretty bad in his quad and had to carry a dog all the way from the gorge to Takotna. That's where he lost a lot of time and a lot of those early spaces in the standings was just that tough trail that they came and encountered on pretty much from Skwitna to about Takotna.
Yeah, it was really kind of brutal for a lot of people, and there were some of the early leaders, which includes Hugh and Lance Mackey, really started falling behind around that part of the race.
Right. So let's talk about who's still out there on the trail. It looks like about 8 mushers left. Has Justin Savedas come in yet, or is he still on his way to Nome?
No, he's still on his way. He's past safety, and he was actually going very, very slowly past safety. He's picked up a little bit of speed, but it looks like he is still about, looks like he's still about 5 or 6 miles out.
So that's about an hour or so in terms of mushing time if he's going as slow as you say you are. So Justin Savedas is in safety. It looks like Travis Cooper and Karen Ramstead have left White Mountain on their way to safety. Jamie Kinzer is in White Mountain. Matt Failer is in White Mountain. And we're going to talk a little bit about Matt in just a few minutes. Hank DeBruin, the Siberian team, is in White Mountain. Dan Seavey is in Koyuk. And Jan Steves and Bob Klupach are in Shaktulik, and I know we've talked about all of those guys on our coverage this year. So it's pretty interesting to carry this all the way through. And as I mentioned earlier in the week, we're going to carry this show through at least Sunday. We're going to do our wrap-up show on Sunday evening, so we're looking forward to that. But before we do, I want to tell a little story about Sylvia Vertwangler. Again, I'm sorry if I butchered it there. We're just going to call her Sylvia throughout the rest of this talk. But Sylvia is staying right up the street from us at Vern Halter's place. Iditarod veteran, I believe he's ran 18 or 19 Iditarods. So she's staying there at the Dream a Dream dog farm, and she's getting ready to head back to Germany and then drive over to Norway tomorrow. And I was over, I guess I got volunteered. I was over helping her pack up all of her gear to take on down to the airport. She has 16 dogs and quite a few crates in this huge aluminum, looks kind of like one of those truck boxes that you'd use in the back of your work truck. She has all of that gear to get from here to Germany and then drive over from Germany to Norway where she lives. And we were talking about the logistics in doing that, and she said that her flight is at 9 p.m. tomorrow, and she has to be down there to Anchorage very early in the morning so she can get all of her dogs, you know, lined up and ready to go. And then, of course, a heck of a long flight from Anchorage to Seattle to Germany. And she was telling me the cost of what it takes. And I know we just posted a article on the Facebook page about Ramey Smith and how much it costs. She was saying that it costs well over $35,000 to get her team back and forth to Germany. And when you think about that, guys, she scratched in Nikolai very soon into the race. So not very far into the race, she ended up scratching. So when we talk about the Boulevard of Broken Dreams and all those things that happened between Willow and Gnome, a heck of a lot of time, a heck of a lot of money is won and lost on that trail. But just another piece to that story is she talked about the reason why she scratched. She said that she came down with a very bad inner ear infection at about Squintna, which is the second checkpoint in the race. So only about 100 miles into the race, she knew she was pretty much done at that second checkpoint. So my question to you, Alex, is what do you think about that, you know, that cost and that endeavor to get all the way over here and then scratch pretty much the second checkpoint? You know, she plugged away a few more down the line, but she was ready to call it quits just 100 miles into the race.
That has to be one of the most heartbreaking things, to realize that after coming all of this way and after putting all of this time and energy and effort, not to mention all of the expense into it, that you really are not going to be able to keep up, and you're not going to be able to do what's best for your dogs, and so you're going to have to stop. I can only imagine how heartbreaking that must be.
Michelle?
And, you know, we
Go ahead, Alex, go ahead.
I was just going to say, when I first started really getting into the Iditarod and becoming aware of it was about 10 years ago when Team Norway was dominant, Robert Sorley and Cadel Becken, who would come over here every year, and I believe one year they even brought two teams over here to compete. They stopped coming over a few years ago simply because the cost of bringing all of their dogs and all of their equipment and support staff over to race in Alaska was just astronomical. And I imagine that with costs of air travel going up, that it's gotten even worse in the past few years.
Totally agree. Totally agree. Michelle?
You know, Alex, do you remember when I was talking on the earlier shows about the Olympics and how mushing would be such a great sport if we brought it back to the Olympics?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in yes. Sylvia's case, I really feel for her and anybody that had to scratch early, just like Wade Morris and Zoya Denure, all of them scratched within the first couple of days. And I feel for them because a musher and the dogs is all there is out there. There isn't a support team. There isn't, you know, like in the Olympics, you show up with the gymnastics team, even though it's one gymnast competing, there's still a team, there's still a coach there's still a support system, and Sylvia's out there on the trail, and she, for the most part, had to make this make or break decision all on her own. You know, there was nobody there going, no, you know, you have an ear infection, but you're going to be okay. You can push forward. You know, there's nobody there saying, in between checkpoints especially, there's nobody there saying, you know what, your dog might not feel well right now. Just give it some time to rest. It'll bounce back and be great. Robert's even experienced that with some of our dogs on the trail, and they bounce back and they're just fine the next day. So, I mean, the undertaking alone of just doing this is a feat in itself, you know, and then you've got support systems like Hugh Neff has, Robert and I watching his dogs and things, but we're still not allowed to help him strategize his race.
Right. And it's, and that tends to get more pronounced as the race goes on, and people become more tired. And it's, I heard an interview that Dallas Seavey gave with our local NPR station here in Southern California this morning. And one of the things that he said is that generally as mushers go further and further into the Iditarod, the way that they think kind of changes in that it becomes harder with all of the exhaustion and having so little sleep to do very simple tasks. And so that becomes harder and harder as you get further and further along the trail.
Exactly. And you know what Sylvia said in her closing remarks when I was talking with her? She had mentioned that her sled has not arrived yet back to Willow. It's still somewhere between here and McGrath. And I said, so where's your sled? You know, as we were loading up the truck for her to head to Anchorage for the airport. And she said, oh, it'll make its way back here. I'll just pick it up next year when I run the race in 2013. What do you think about that, Alec?
You know, my favorite book about the Iditarod is the Gary Paulson book, Winter Dance. And for people who haven't read it, please go and read it. Get it out of the library. Buy it. Buy it online, buy it at your local bookstore. It's a fantastic book about the Iditarod, and the subtitle of it is The Fine Madness of Running the Iditarod. And there's a great thing very near the end of the book where he runs through all of the things that have happened to him while he's running the race, and it includes spraining muscles and a possible broken bone and a couple of other things involving hemorrhoids that we don't have to get into on a family show, and how he was sleep deprived and all of these sort of things. And then he talks about how as soon as he finished, a reporter came up and interviewed him and said, well, what do you think of the race? And he thought back to all of these horrible things that he'd experienced. And then the interviewer said, well, are you going to come back next year? And he said, of course I am, and I'm going to win.
There you
go. It's that the spirit of running this race just gets into people's bones. It gets into your blood. And it's just, it kind of defies all rational thought, but people just fall in love with Iditarod and want to come back over and over again.
And that's a great segue into our topic tonight. It's running puppy teams. And you'll often find handlers or support staff or family members, whether it's a husband and wife team, somebody is always going to run the B team, not necessarily in the Iditarod, but at least in training and possibly some upcoming races like the Connect 200 or the Testamina or the Copper Basin. And each year in the Iditarod, we always have a couple of teams out there where they have entered a second team. And this year, I don't know exactly all of the teams, but I know Matt Fahler from Martin Boosser's Kennel is running the puppy team or B team. And then Ryan Olson, a young lady, is running the B team. I guess it's the black team in the way that they talk about it for Ali Zirkel. Do you know of anybody else that's running the B teams for any of these mushers, Alex?
Yeah, there's a couple of other ones that I'm aware of. Dan Seavey, of course, is running the, I guess the C team this would be for the Seavey Kennel. Mostly yearlings, and Trent Herbst, whom we're going to talk about later, is actually running Jake Berkowitz's B team. this year.
So I know you wanted to mention the purposes in that, and I can give some musher perspective on that, but what do you have to say about these B teams or puppy teams, yearling teams, et cetera?
Well, for a lot of these teams, and the term puppy team is a little misleading. They don't actually take puppies down the Iditarod Trail. I think that would be a little bit cruel and disastrous. But these are generally dogs that are around 2 years old. For the most part, these are dogs that have done training runs that are familiar with being in harness and being part of a dog team. Generally speaking, they're not dogs that have done particularly long runs. They may have done a shorter race, a 100-mile race or a 200-mile race, and certainly they've done lots of training runs. But the idea with these dog teams is to get them used to being on a longer trail and to get them used to the sustained run-rest cycle. And for a lot of these so-called puppy teams, they need a lot more rest. And so you will find Dan Seavey said that he was running exactly the race he wanted to run, even though he was in last or almost last place throughout it, because he just was giving the dogs exactly the amount of rest that he had planned to give them and that they really needed. So the idea is that you get the dogs used to this longer run so that the next year or in 2 years, they'll be familiar with the trail and they'll be able to go up the trail and to really perform at the caliber of the main teams, the main Iditarod dog teams.
You know, Hugh, most mushers consider puppies, any dog that's on their team that is as much as 3 years or younger. 3 years is really the prime age that we start running dogs in serious races. So it's good that you point out they're not running 12-week-olds. They're
right.
Not running 6-month-olds. They've got to be at least a year old before any musher will even consider putting them in harness on any team. So I just wanted to point that out. But it's also good that you mentioned about the puppies and the rest and things, but it's also partly the experience. They want these dogs to experience the different types of trails, the different types of weather, the energy that's out there on the trail when they come into those checkpoints and when they leave Anchorage. All of that is brand new to a two-year-old puppy who is highly distracted as it is. And if you're running Siberians like Karen and Hank, then it's all too often that you end up with running Siberians that are closer to 4 or 5 years old instead of 2 or 3, because they need that extra experience out there before you really can trust them to get you to know them.
Yeah, and, you know, also, depending on where the dogs live and where they train, there are also additional wildlife experiences that they might not be exposed to. And so you might want you would want your dog to be able to have the experience of knowing what to do if they're on the trail and there is, you know, a moose in the vicinity, or if they're on the trail and there's a wolf or some other animal that they might not encounter when they're just training around their home kennel.
And speaking of wildlife, for these puppy teams, you have to take into account that 30 or 40 mile tailgate party, what is known as the world's largest tailgate party in between Willow and Yetna Station. That is tough on a dog team, no matter if it's your first year or your eighth year in harness on your way to Nome. Dealing with all those people, all of those crowds, all of those sounds is detrimental to making a very quality dog team. And the only thing I want to mention in regards to this conversation is a lot of the reason that these guys are running these dog teams is to make the run fun for the dogs. You don't want to put too much pressure on these young puppy teams. You want them to enjoy the trip to Nome. You don't want to burn them out. You don't want to, you know, cause undue stress for them. You want to make this trip fun for them, because more than likely these guys will go from Willow to Nome 8 or 9 times. I know in that article that we just posted from Ramey Smith, he said that his front end, his main leader, Scotty or Scott, I don't remember which, has been to Nome 8 times, and this is his last race. So I'm sure he started as a very young dog, and now he's finishing up, and the next group or batch of dogs is on their way to take Scotty's place. Do you know anything about Ramey's lead dog Scotty or Scott, whichever one it is?
Yeah, just what you just reported. And again, you know, as we've talked about several times, it's not only the lead dog retiring, but a lot of times you'll have dog teams, especially where the dogs are very experienced or have run a lot of races, and after a while, you know, when they get to be 10, 11, 12 years old, they're usually retired, and then you have a lot of turnover on your dog team, and it's almost misleading because we talk about the mushers and we identify the race only based on the mushers. And as anyone who follows the sport knows, it's really the dogs who are the athletes. It just would be a little bit unwieldy if we had to keep track of 1,100 or 1,200 different dogs.
That's exactly right. And when you mention retiring, you know, that's a question that a lot of folks have, and I'm glad we can talk about that for just a second. Oftentimes, a lot of these retired dogs, and of course, every mushing kennel is a little bit different. The kennel that I share duties with, they're a serum run kennel, but what they do is every dog that they have dies at the kennel. They do not place them, you know, they finish out their days, and then they eventually, you know, die of old age there at that kennel. And that's how a lot of these kennels are set up. They end up keeping them for the life of their dog. But a lot of these guys also place a lot of these retired dogs with recreational teams or, you know, just teams that can just putz around the neighborhood that aren't doing these 1,000-mile runs anymore, and they just give them or sell them to less experienced mushers or recreational teams. Do you have anything to add to that, Alex?
Yeah, and these dogs, because they've had so much experience and because they've been on the trail and had a lot of miles under their belts, are really wonderful dogs for being around other dogs who are just starting to pull sleds and being around people who just want to be a little bit part of kind of the amateur version of the mushing lifestyle and not necessarily run the Iditarod and maybe not even run smaller races, but they just like the idea of being with a dog team and being on the runners behind the dogs and getting to experience the outdoors and being on the trail with their dogs.
You know, Alex, the old dogs do exactly that. They're great teachers for young teams. And I know that Robert and I have utilized older dogs a lot of times teaching our younger dogs in the off season. And not only the younger dogs, but sometimes you'll have a middle-aged dog, if you will, a dog between 3 and 6 that gets a little spry. And if you throw an older dog next to him on the gang line for a few runs, you'll be surprised how that spry dog gets put right back in his place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also, and I don't know how common this is, but I know that some people also, when they have sled dogs that are retiring, place the sled dogs with families or with people who do not mush, and they just sort of become house dogs. And I'm not sure how often that happens, but I know of a couple of cases where it has happened. And
yeah, it does happen from time to time, but you guys have to remember, these are athletes. These are bred and born to pull. So they're not going to necessarily be the lay at your lap while you're watching Monday Night Football, lay at your feet while you're watching Monday Night Football type of dogs. These are hardcore athletes. So, yeah, they can make good house dogs, good family dogs, but, you know, they have an entirely different makeup than a lot of the house dogs today that are sitting around eating bacon strips, getting fat and happy.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think even when these dogs become house dogs, they secretly just are looking for any chance they can to go and run.
Right. And I just want to mention one more thing in regards to these puppy teams or retired dogs. I believe Dallas Seavey said it best. He said in an interview today or in the last few days, he said, you know what? I came to Nome and won this year with a team of dogs that nobody else wanted for one reason or another, whether he bought them or acquired them from one kennel or another. He went to Nome with these dogs that somebody else didn't want.
Yeah, and you know, we've sort of touched on this a couple of times, but there is a real art to putting together a championship team and knowing which dogs are going to work well in which positions, and also which dogs are going to work well with each other and become the kind of championship caliber team that you might not suspect they would be just looking at the dogs individually.
Well, you know, Dallas did something a little unorthodox this year, and I really got to say, awesome job, Dallas, because not only are you 25 years old, but you thought outside of the box and you built your team on the trail. And that's not the usual way that it's done. Usually mushers like Robert spends a couple of years designing and building a team and thinking it out and you know, overanalyzing. And Dallas, he'd be the first to tell you, he built this team while he was out there.
Yeah, and it's really amazing that he was able to come up with this idea and then to execute it. And I'm sure that there were some things in his race plan that did change as he was going down the trail, and he was able to adapt them. But he really was thinking several days in advance rather than just reacting to exactly what the conditions were in front of him. And that is a remarkable thing and shows really a maturity and a depth of knowledge about the sport that is certainly surprising for a 25-year-old, maybe not a 25-year-old raised in the CV family, but it definitely is indicative that this is going to be someone who's going to be a real force in the sport for a very long time to come.
If I can, Alex, I have to say a little bit in tongue-in-cheek here. He wasn't thinking about race plans. He wasn't thinking about strategy. I heard him say today on one of the local radio shows, he thought very early in the race that he wasn't going to run after a belt buckle anymore. He was running after that truck. And that's exactly what his motivation was. And then shortly thereafter in the interview, he says, you're going to bet you're going to see that truck, a very happy musher driving that truck through Wasilla very soon.
well, good for him.
I totally agree.
He completely deserves to be driving that truck happily wherever he goes.
Exactly. So we're looking forward to seeing Dallas on the Parks Highway pretty soon. I'm sure he's amped up and ready to do that. But before we run out of time here, Alex, I know we want to talk about our featured musher of the day. It is Trent Herbst. I know we've talked about him a couple of times in our coverage, and as we've mentioned all throughout, we try to focus each night on a musher that a lot of folks don't know anything about. We don't necessarily talk about the Mackies and the CVs and the Neffs and the John Rose and all the people that everybody knows everything about. We talk about the middle-of-the-packer guys or the back-of-the-pack guys that have a special story, and I know Trent does. Go ahead and share that with us, Alex.
Okay, Trent Herbst is perhaps best known to Iditarod fans as the teacher. He used to live in Ketchum, Idaho. He just moved to Anchorage. This is a guy who has taught all over the world, third and fourth grade classes. And, in fact, he was teaching in Europe when someone introduced him to the Iditarod, and he fell in love with the race and decided that he wanted to learn more about mushing, got behind the runners when he moved to Michigan, and then was living in Michigan and Idaho and training, and part-time living in Alaska and training to run races like the Iditarod. He ran his first Iditarod in 2006 and finished in 68th place. In 2010, he was in 49th. He was the first musher to the halfway point last year, and also won the most improved musher in the Iditarod in 2011, and the most inspirational musher award in 2009 when he finished 48th. But the story that I wanted to tell about Trent is a story from the 2010 Iditarod, and he is very, very involved with using the Iditarod as an educational tool. And if you go to his website, which is trentherbst.com. He has lesson plans, and he has some things that classrooms can use to use the Iditarod as a teaching tool. In 2010, and I believe in several of the other years as well, he had a class project where he had his students build dog racing sleds. And the sled that he took to Nome was a sled that had been built by his fourth graders. And one of the items that Iditarod mushers are required to carry with them on the trail is snowshoes, which a lot of mushers these days will tell you they never use their snowshoes. In the early days of the race, when the trail wasn't broken as well or as much, mushers would often go ahead and snowshoe and then as a way of breaking trail. Trent Herbst had a teaching plan where he had his kids build snowshoes in 2009 and 2010. And they built snowshoes according to the old-style Athabascan methods of snowshoe building. And there is a guy in Ruby, a native gentleman named George Albert, who is the premier builder of Athabascan snowshoes. And apparently, if you want your genuine Athabascan snowshoes, there's nothing you can get that's finer than a pair built by George Albert. So Trent, in 2010, had his students build snowshoes, and he took a pair of these snowshoes with him up the trail and gave them to George Albert in Ruby. And George Albert told him that he has built and sold and given away thousands of pairs of snowshoes in his life to mushers, including a lot of very famous Iditarod mushers. But up until then, no one had ever brought him snowshoes that they had made. And Trent said that was the highlight of his Iditarod career, at least so far.
That's awesome. You know, that goes back to that, what is the saying, pay it forward? Michelle, I know you've mentioned that from time to time. Where
I live by that.
There you go. But what a great story to talk about today as we're drawing close to the end of the Iditarod. Trent came in 37th place this year. So, again, very respectable finish, not too bad in terms of the standings. But you got to admire a guy that looks exactly like a musher. He looks exactly like Yukon Cornelius.
he really does. And he moved to Alaska partially because he wanted to get more involved in the mushing lifestyle and be able to run more races. He ran the Yukon Quest this year for the first time. And he's a wonderful guy, a very personable guy, always willing to talk to people and share things about education and about the Iditarod.
Yeah, and we've talked about that in our coverage. If you go back and listen to some of our older shows, and remember, guys, these are available anytime. So if you have an Iditarod fix in June or July, just make sure you head over to mushingradio.com, and you can listen to some of these old 2012 Iditarod shows. It's always good entertainment because we're not necessarily talking about who's winning and who's losing. We cover these stories each night as well. So, again, a great story about Trent Herbst. You know, we only have one more night to talk about a featured musher. Who is going to be the last one on your list, Alex?
At the moment, I have no idea. I'm open to any and all suggestions.
Keep the suspense up till the very end, that's for sure.
Yeah, we'll have to tease it so people will tune in tomorrow.
So also on Sunday, I don't know if they're going to be done by the time we're on. I'm not sure what time the banquet is, but they give out a heck of a lot of awards at the banquet. Of course, it's the awards banquet for the Iditarod, and I know that they've already given out several awards that they give out on the trail, like the first to cripple and, you know, the first to the coast and that sort of thing. But during the banquet, they obviously give out the Rookie of the Year award, they give out the Sportsmanship award, the Best Cared Team award, all of those very special accolades to some of these guys. Do you know much about those awards, Alex?
Yeah, and they also, at the banquet, at the finishers banquet, which goes on for a long time, it's a wonderful event, but it does go on for a while. They also give out all of the awards that were won on the trail again. So they'll have the the Spirit of Alaska Award, which Ali Zirkel won, will be formally presented again at the banquet, as well as all of these other awards. And following that, they introduce each of the mushers in reverse order from the way they finished. So the last one first, and the mushers basically can come up and make speeches of, I believe, however long they want to keep talking. And for some of them, a lot of these mushers are a little bit shy or overcome by emotion and won't talk for very long. But there are some mushers who will just get up and talk for quite a while. It's very interesting because you get a real sense of who these people are. Almost all of them will thank profusely the volunteers and the people who behind the scenes really make this race possible. There's a lot of people tell stories about things that happened to them on the trail, and they thank their sponsors and they thank their girlfriends or boyfriends or husbands or wives. And it's really an opportunity for the entire mushing community to get together and celebrate the race that has just ended and really to celebrate each other as well.
You know, I have to say something about a California guy here, Alex, because I know living down there and I know you're a huge fan of the Academy Awards show. And just recently, you were talking on Twitter, you and I mentioned a couple of times about the Academy Awards this year and Billy Crystal and the whole nine yards. My only question to you, I think you've sat through this awards banquet. Is it as fun as a Billy Crystal hosted Academy Awards?
It's more fun. there aren't nearly enough sled dogs at the Billy Crystal hosted Academy Awards. It's a huge party. It's pretty much everyone who is in Nome, who doesn't live in Nome, will go to this awards banquet. And I believe that they have the chefs from the Millennium Hotel who prepare all the food. They fly in prime rib and fresh fruit and strawberries and desserts of all manner, and it's just a really, really fun time. It's also one last time when everybody is together and you can go up and talk to any of the mushers that you want, and there is no pressure from the race anymore, and everyone is very friendly, and it's a real celebratory mood.
Do you think that all of the guys and gals will be in by the time of the banquet? I know Jan Steves and Bob Klupach are in 52nd, 53rd place at the moment. They are on their way to Koyuk from Shaktulik. I believe they should be in Nome by Sunday, which is the banquet. I'm not sure what time the banquet starts, but it's my understanding that they should be there by then. Do you think?
I think they should, provided they make it across the ice at Norton Bay, which has been taking people a tremendously long amount of time. The front runners made it across fairly easily, but then the wind has really, really picked up in the past several days, and Dan Seavey camped out on the ice, and I believe it took him almost 18 hours to get from Shaktulik to Koyuk. And Karen Ramstead had her GPS on her sled is still in the middle of the ice. She got a new one at White Mountain, so you can now track her, but her old GPS device is still somewhere on the ice there. And I, as we pointed out, it does have its own Facebook page now, so you can be a fan of Karen Ramstead's wayward wandering GPS device if you want to do that on Facebook.
I wonder if it can see Russia from there.
I think it would be lucky if it could see Koyuk from there.
That was a Sarah Palin joke. As you can tell, we're winding down our Iditarod coverage and cracking a few jokes on this show. So that again, no harm to Sarah at all up here in her country. Alex, we have just a couple of minutes. Any last words for today? Anything you want to mention about tomorrow? And then we'll turn it over to Michelle before we close.
You know, just to keep in mind that there are still teams on the trail. There's a couple of people who will be leaving White Mountain fairly soon. Justin Civita should be coming into Nome sometime within the next half hour or so. And then behind him, Travis Cooper, I think, is probably maybe 3 or 4 hours out. And Karen Ramstead will be coming in probably overnight. So as long as there are people on the trail, this race is still going on. And, you know, we've said many times before on this show and off this show as well that anyone who completes this race has performed an amazing accomplishment. And it doesn't matter if you are first or second or 53rd or 68th. If you've completed an Iditarod, that is something that almost no one on earth has done. And it's something that should be celebrated.
That's the reason why we're doing this show, to celebrate everybody that's involved with this, the mushers, the dogs, the people, the support staff, all of the volunteers. That's why we're doing this. Not only do we love the sport of mushing and what it represents, but also all of that that goes into it. I'm so thankful that we're doing this for these guys. Michelle, some final words?
You know, I just want to say that it doesn't matter if you scratch or if you win. Trent Herbst, our featured musher tonight, is one of the reasons why people get out there and they do it year after year. Yes, like Ramey Smith mentioned, it costs $30,000. Yes, like Sylvia mentioned, it cost her $35,000 just to get here. It is costly, but Trent really shows the reason why you come back and do it over and over again.
I totally agree. Alex, any final words here before we close?
I couldn't have said it any better, Michelle. These people are very inspirational, and we just want to celebrate all of them.
Very good. So this is Robert Forto on behalf of my co-host today, Michelle on my right, and my good friend Alex Stein calling in from California. We will be on the air tomorrow night as well. Make sure you join us on mushingradio.com or blogtalkradio.com/dogworks. And make sure you head over to our Facebook page and hit that like button, because you can still be entered to win an advanced copy of Alex's movie, Mush the Movie, a documentary about this Iditarod that we've all come to love. So until tomorrow, we'll talk to you guys soon. Goodbye.